It is Thursday, November 2nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump calls for the death penalty for the alleged New York City bike pack attacker. We get reaction from a law professor.
And it's not only that that's premature, it's that you have a real concern about potentially coloring or otherwise tinting the jury pool.
Today marks the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration, and a new stage production examines addiction. It's all ahead. U.S. President Donald Trump still thinks the Uzbek immigrant accused of running down eight people with a truck in New York City ought to get the death penalty. But the president is backing away from trying to send him to the U.S. Detention Center for suspected terrorists at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Trump said Thursday he would love to send the New York City terrorist to Guantanamo, but statistically that process takes much longer than handling his trial through the U.S. court system. Trump tweeted of sending 29-year-old Saifullo Saipov to trial in New York. Should move fast. Death penalty. Stephen Vladek is professor of law at the University of Texas. He wrote an opinion piece in Thursday's Washington Post newspaper criticizing President Trump's proposal to send Saipov to Guantanamo Bay. Speaking from Austin, he tells me why.
Well, I mean, I think there's no reason why we need to send someone like, you know, Saipov to Guantanamo. The civilian courts have been incredibly efficient and competent at handling even high-profile terrorism cases. I think Guantanamo has all of this baggage related to the abuses that have been committed there over the last 15 years. And I think there are these serious legal questions about whether we would even have the power to detain in potentially indefinite military custody someone who is, you know, lawfully present in the United States at the time of their arrest, like Saipov. It's not at all clear to me that the government would want to even test the legal boundaries of their power in such cases, especially where the claim is not that he is a member of Al-Qaeda, but that he's a member of ISIS, a very different group from the one Congress authorized the use of force against back in 2001.
Well, today President Trump also, he mentioned the, you know, using the death penalty in this case. Some legal observers might say that could be a little premature.
Well, not just premature. I mean, President Trump didn't just mention using the death penalty. President Trump said on Twitter that Saipov should get the death penalty. And it's not only that that's premature, it's that you have a real concern about potentially coloring or otherwise tainting the jury pool. You know, especially in capital cases, we tend to be very careful about making sure that the jury is making up their own mind, that they're not reaching these verdicts and these sentences because they feel like there's some kind of external societal pressure to do so. And so it's just not helpful. It's a rather serious breach of some fairly longstanding norms for the president to go on Twitter and demand a specific sentence in a case that really has just gotten off the ground.
Yeah, I know in the past, not on Twitter, but other presidents have sort of weighed their personal opinions about legal cases, and that sort of hurt them.
Well, so yes, I mean, there have been consequences in the past. I mean, President Obama got in trouble for suggesting that, you know, even as a general proposition, the punishments for sex assault cases in the military weren't serious enough, and that wasn't even talking about specific defendants. But I think, you know, the larger point here is that it's just not a good idea, no matter what you think the right result is for a suspect like Saipov, for the president to be going on Twitter, on television, in any public forum, and basically prejudging the outcome of the trial. The whole reason why we have so much faith in our criminal justice system is because we expect the trials to be fair and free from these kinds of outside influences.
Saipov has been speaking with authorities in New York, and apparently he has waived his Miranda rights and talked, you know, a lot about what he did, or allegedly, you know, what he did. But is this fairly unusual for a suspect in a case to waive his or her Miranda rights?
You know, I think it's actually not as unusual as people might think. I mean, and this is a pretty, you know, important point that I think gets lost on folks like Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, Senator John McCain from Arizona. You know, interrogating suspects in these cases is actually often quite fruitful, even in the civilian criminal justice system, because many of these individuals, once they're captured, once they're arrested, they actually decide either to cooperate or at the very least that there's no harm in just not talking. And so I think, you know, what really sort of comes through here is that all of the reasons that have been offered for treating Saipov differently, for holding him in military detention, for subjecting him to additional interrogation methods aren't even necessary here, because by all accounts, he's cooperating. You know, I don't know if we'll ever know why he's cooperating, but I think the fact that he is just takes all of the pressure off of these calls to send him to Guantanamo to put him in a military brig.
Could a lawyer, though, later on say, well, his client was under the influence of medication or was in shock or that kind of thing?
I mean, I'm sure a lawyer could try to argue that. But, you know, if I had to guess, the government, I'm sure, has been extremely careful to memorialize every single aspect of his Miranda waiver to make sure that it can prove to a judge that the Miranda waiver was knowing and voluntary. I mean, this is not the government's first time, you know, around this particular rodeo. And I think that's the point that gets lost on those who think Guantanamo is the right answer. We have had hundreds of these cases in the civilian federal courts since 9/11. We have well-established procedures that the FBI knows how to follow. When you start talking about Guantanamo, you're talking about the unknown. And I just don't know why, in a case of this importance, you know, for a crime of this magnitude, we'd really want to take that kind of chance.
Stephen Vladeck, professor of law at the University of Texas. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's trending?
Well, a big story trending this week in Washington, representatives from Twitter, Facebook, and Google testifying on Capitol Hill about Russian interference and misinformation on their platforms. And a lot of different elements coming out of these hearings. We see back and forth, sometimes tense back and forth between the top lawyers for these companies who were testifying and the senators asking why they couldn't do more to police the ads that were purchased by Russia. We even saw some of the ads come out and looking at how they appeal to people in the Black Lives Matter movement or gun rights advocates to try to divide the American public. But one instance I wanted to talk about, it was kind of a unique way to highlight the influence and impact of these ads. Two senators on the Intelligence Committee in the Senate, Mark Warner and Amy Klobuchar, they've come up with a bill called the Honest Ads Act, which would require social networks to provide information about who's buying these ads, how much they're spending, and who they're targeting. Now, during the hearings this week, these two senators created a fake Facebook group called Americans for Disclosure Solutions, which has the acronym ADS, or ads, so kind of clever wordplay there. They spent just $40 total to reach about 1,400 Capitol Hill staffers and about 1,400 Washington journalists in the course of 24 hours. They said at no point when they were doing this was it clear what this group was, what it stood for, why they were advertising, and how much they were spending. And they said if it was that easy for them to do it, and reach so many people, imagine what countries like Russia must think. So that was one instance in this hearing where we saw kind of a creative use of social media to make the point directly to the social media companies. And we'll have to continue to monitor that to see as this develops. I'm sure this is not going to be the last hearing. They're already talking about potentially bringing Mark Zuckerberg, Jack Dorsey, the CEOs of these companies, to testify on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, that should be very interesting.
Yes. The other big story, of course, you just talked about the terror attack in New York, and an instance where social media caused some issues with some comments on social media from a conservative activist named Laura Loomer. She, after the attack, went on social media and said that she would not use the car services Lyft and Uber because she didn't want to be driven by a Muslim driver and didn't want to support Islamic immigrant drivers for those car services. So this caused a social media uproar, people saying that she should be banned by Twitter for her racist, anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim comments. No word from Twitter yet, but both the ride-sharing apps she mentioned, Uber and Lyft, are speaking out, and they have announced that they have banned her from using those apps, saying that she violated their terms of service by attacking their drivers, even though it wasn't a specific driver, just the whole class of drivers, by saying she wouldn't ride with any Muslim drivers. So those two companies saying, we will not stand up for hate, and Laura Loomer is going to have to find another way to get around Manhattan.
No, I guess so. All right. Well, thank you very much, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. A Spanish judge orders 9 former Catalan leaders to be jailed. South Korea says the North appears to be planning a new missile test. Pakistan says efforts are in progress to find a missing Afghan government official. And Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi visits the troubled Rakhine state. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
British astronomers say they discovered a monster planet orbiting a tiny star. But according to planet formation theory, the planet should not even exist. The theory suggests a planet of its size could not be formed around such a small star. Located about 600 light-years from Earth, the planet, dubbed NGTS-1b, is a gas giant and classified as a hot Jupiter, which means it's physically similar to our solar system's biggest planet, but is much hotter since it orbits its sun from a close distance. The astronomers say that NGTS-1b circles its star so closely that it's just 3% of the distance Earth is to the sun. 1 year on the planet only lasts 2.6 Earth days. While the planet may be large, its host star is small, with half the radius and mass of our own sun. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a new stage production in New York looks at the pitfalls of addiction. Thursday marked the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. It was a 67-word pledge written by British Foreign Secretary Lord Arthur Balfour in a letter to financier and Zionist leader Lord Walter Rothschild to help create a Jewish homeland in Palestine. It also cautioned that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. The declaration, which came during the First World War, served as the basis for what came to be called the British Mandate of Palestine, approved by the League of Nations in 1920. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu marked the occasion Thursday in London and spoke of its importance during his trip to Britain.
I very much appreciate this gesture by the Prime Minister of Britain and the government of Great Britain. The Palestinians say that the Balfour Declaration was a tragedy. That wasn't a tragedy. What's been tragic is their refusal to accept this 100 years later. I hope they change their mind, because if they do, we can move forward finally to making peace between our two peoples.
Palestinians, still in search of their own state, have demanded an apology from Britain for the declaration, which resulted in the mass displacement of their people in 1948, a matter that continues to reverberate today. Palestinian Foreign Minister Raed Malki said Britain should make this historical oppression right by recognizing the state of Palestine and apologizing to the Palestinian people. Russell Stone is Professor Emeritus at the American University Center for Israel Studies. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty Lord Balfour was deliberate in using vague and ambiguous language.
It said the British government viewed with favor, it didn't establish anything, the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. It didn't say what the nature of that would be either, and it went on to further state that it would not in any way affect the rights of other people living in the area. It was conveyed in a letter to Lord Rothschild of England, who in turn was expected to transmit it to the organized Jewish community in England, representing the emerging ideals of Zionism, the creation of a Jewish national state in Palestine.
An author of a book on the document, Jonathan Schneer, says it's so divisive, referring to the Balfour Declaration today. Zionists think that the Balfour Declaration laid the foundation stone for modern Israel. They're right to think that. By the same token, non-Jewish Palestinians and Arabs see it as the foundation stone of their dispossession and misery.
Well, it certainly marked a turning point for them as well. They had been governed before that by the Ottoman Empire out of Turkey, and it was really a minor province of the Ottoman Empire. So they were left more or less on their own. There wasn't a huge Arab population in the area, but it was larger than the Jewish population.
Writing this week in the Daily Telegraph, the British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson said he's a friend of Israel, but he also said he's, quote, deeply moved by the suffering of those affected and dislodged by the birth of the Balfour Declaration in the modern-day state of Israel. Quote, the vital caveat in the Balfour Declaration intended to safeguard other communities has not been fully realized.
This is a reaction to the demand by organized Palestinians for an apology from England for what has happened to them. England was trying to pull out of the area at the time.
Looking forward to the future, what do you think the Balfour Declaration will mean for Israel and the Palestinians?
Well, it's 100 years. It's just an anniversary that generates a certain amount of attention, but that in itself will not have any influence on the future of the situation. That future depends on whether some agreement or accommodation can take place between Israelis and Palestinians in how to live together in the area, politically as well as socially and economically.
Are you optimistic or pessimistic?
Guardedly patient. Peace isn't going to break out tomorrow. We can only hope that in the long run, a modus vivendi will emerge. I'm not optimistic in the short run, but we must remain hopeful in the long run.
That's Russell Stone, Professor Emeritus at the American University Center for Israel Studies. In London, thousands are expected to converge Saturday for a rally with the theme Make It Right for Palestine, organized to demand justice and equal rights for Palestinians. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. A play about addiction has just opened in New York. The dramatic struggle against the grip of drugs or alcohol is not a new subject. In fact, it's very much in the news today. The Presidential Commission on the Opioid Crisis just issued its recommendations for dealing with the epidemic, which kills 91 Americans every day. The latest exploration of the issue on stage is called People, Places, and Things. Jeff London reports that the play takes an unsentimental and at times harrowing look at addiction and recovery.
The lights come up in the middle of a scene from Chekhov's The Seagull.
Things don't hurt me so much anymore.
Emma, the actress playing Nina, is woozy and disoriented, clearly high or drunk or both. She collapses and all hell breaks loose on stage. Lights flash, loud music plays, actors dressed as EMS workers strip her of her Victorian costume, gurneys whiz by. It's the start of a journey which takes Emma on the painful and difficult road towards recovery. Denise Goff plays the actress.
On paper, it sounds like a nightmare at the theater, right? You know, watching an actress who's addicted to drugs trying to get clean and sober. I mean, oh my God. But actually, it's just a metaphor for a person who wears masks in all areas and then trying to keep all the masks going.
I know people in recovery. I know people with addiction issues.
Playwright Duncan McMillan.
I know people, even in the course of researching and working on this play, several of the people who I was thinking of and talking to about it died.
So McMillan says he did not want to resort to tired old stereotypes about addicts.
That they're these tragic people who can only die to serve the narrative. And I was interested in sort of redressing that and trying to find a way to accurately represent and respectfully represent the daily struggle and the daily work of living in recovery.
At the center of the play is the 12-step program, a widely used set of guiding principles outlining a course of action for recovery. Steps 2 and 3 acknowledge the existence of a God who will save you. That is hard for Emma, and it was for Duncan McMillan, too.
It's something I absolutely struggled with. When I started researching and thinking a lot about 12 steps, I just thought, well, God, if I had to do this, I would not be able to surrender my critical faculties so easily. And if that's what's required to save my life, I think I'm not going to make this. And the journey I've gone on in writing this play, I've softened a lot about all of that stuff, because essentially it's just about realizing that there are things that are beyond your control, that you can't control.
Have you heard the expression powerless over nouns?
Nouns, as in
people, places, and things.
You mean like Facebook?
Excuse me?
On Facebook, the search box says...
I'm not on Facebook.
No. Nor am I, really. I have a profile, but I hardly ever...
It's a rewrite of step 1 of 12. Instead of declaring ourselves powerless over alcohol and drugs, we admit that we are powerless over people, places, and things. People who make us want to relapse, places we associate with using, and things that reactivate old behaviour. Does this make sense to you?
Yes.
Part of the process the addicts go through at the recovery center, where most of the play takes place, is rehearsing what they will say to people out in the quote-unquote real world. That comes naturally for the character Emma, who is an actress. But once she ventures outside and confronts those people, places, and things, she gets knocked for a loop all over again, says actress Denise Goff.
You don't know at the end of the play if she's going to be all right, and that's really important because we can't know. I didn't want to be in a play that sugarcoated any of this. There's no point. I've met and know and have been around too many people who have suffered this disease to go on stage and say there's a happy ending. We don't know that. It's one day at a time.
And that is a life and death point, playwright Duncan McMillan says he wanted to make.
One day at a time. And life has to win every single day, and death only has to win once.
For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has announced that pending consultation with Congress, the United States will provide up to $60 million to support a promising and developing regional counterterrorism effort in the Sahel. The assistance will support activities for a joint counterterrorism force that the Group of Five, G5 Sahel states, Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger, agreed to set up earlier this year to fight terrorist and violent extremist groups such as Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, ISIS, and associated groups. In a statement, Secretary Tillerson said, defeating terrorism depends on making sure terrorist organizations cannot have safe havens on any continent. This is a fight we must win, and these funds will play a key role in achieving that mission. He went on to say that this pledge will bolster our regional partners in their fight to ensure security and stability in the face of ISIS and affiliated groups and other terrorist networks. In remarks at a Security Council briefing on peace and security in Africa, U.S. Representative to the United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley spoke of the violence that has spread across the Sahel. Not only from terrorists, but from criminals who traffic in drugs and human beings, seeking to profit from the chaos in the region. She praised the men and women of the armed forces of the G5 Sahel countries, as well as the UN peacekeepers who are serving in the world's most dangerous peacekeeping mission in Mali. Ambassador Haley promised that the United States will continue its longstanding bilateral support to the G5 members' security forces. Speaking of the new pledge of up to $60 million for the Joint Counterterrorism Force through bilateral assistance, she noted that the force will need ongoing support and that the United States is eager for opportunities to work closely with its partners to make the effort a successful one. Ambassador Haley emphasized, however, that the G5 force must be first and foremost owned by the countries of the region themselves. We expect, she said, that the G5 countries will take on full regional ownership of the force within a period of 3 to 6 years, with continued U.S. engagement. This is the approach that will be most effective in the end, in freeing the region from terror. We welcome this regional ownership of security and stabilization in the Sahel, said Ambassador Haley, and we will continue to stand with the people of the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.